Okay, I want to continue with the digital invasion. And Steve gave me a little Dilbert comic here today that he found in the paper, which is very fitting. And I'll try to explain it as I read it. But there's Dilbert standing there. He's talking to a guy that's looking at his smartphone. And Dilbert says, "Studies say people are losing their ability to focus because of all the digital distractions." The guy looking at his phone says, "Sorry, what?" Dilbert says, "Hold on." And he pulls out his phone. The guy says, "What were you saying?" He says, "I don't know. Probably wasn't important." Oh. So last time, we talked about the need for human connection and how it's important to have real face-to-face connections with people instead of these digital virtual connections, which aren't really much of any connection at all. And we also talked about narcissism, and which is just an old word for pride. We showed that how social networking really is a breeding ground for pride and narcissism, because it's a place where people can go and just talk about themselves voluminously, endlessly, and have an audience for it, or at least they think they have an audience for it. So now I'd like to talk about the tendency to share and gossip too much online. This is another problem with the digital invasion. And, you know, men have a propensity to talk too much anyway and to say things that they ought not to. But then give them the internet and just let them sit there in their house when they don't even have to be in front of somebody. And then give them an audience of 300 people. And this problem really accentuates itself. So social networking sites like Facebook, Twitter provide an easy avenue to blab things that we should not or would not normally have the opportunity to do in real life. You wouldn't have the opportunity to tell 300 people that you just went out for coffee this morning and had a good mocha. You know, nobody would even care if you called up 300 people and told them that anyway. But you wouldn't even have the opportunity. I think the definition of Twitter is telling. This is kind of comical. To Twitter, the verb, it's when it's spoken of a bird, it's to utter a succession of light, tremulous notes, to chirp continuously with a tremulous effect. When it's spoken of a person, it's to sing after the above manner, also, parentheses, especially of a woman. Now, I didn't say that. That's the dictionary, okay? I don't want any comments from the peanut gallery, okay? Especially of a woman, to talk or chatter rapidly in a small or tremulous voice. That's what it means to Twitter. So I think it's interesting that the social networking site Twitter is very fitting of that. You talk in small little bursts with tremulous voice, spurts. Now, when things are written online, they can't be taken back and they're saved forever. See, you know, and I have a good quote here for you later, which says that you can never take a word back. And that's a paraphrase. The quote's better. But anyway, you can't take it. We've all heard that. You can't take something you say back. But when you say it online, you really can't take it back because it's saved there forever. And if the person you sent it to didn't save it, the NSA saved it out in Utah. It's saved somewhere. Somebody has it. And there's no going back. Even if you delete what you put on Facebook, Facebook saves that. And if you said something really stupid, somebody can take a screenshot. And they can save it. I mean, even if you delete it, somebody can still have it. So we all need to be very careful what we say and how much we say. Be cautious about tweeting too much. And I don't mean just with the social networking site Twitter. I mean tweeting in general. Now, as Christians, we should keep the door of our lips. Look at Psalm 141 and verse 3. This is a serious thing. You know, when James talks about the tongue, he says that men have tamed all types of beasts throughout the earth, but the tongue can no man tame. He calls it a world of iniquity. It's set on fire of hell. I mean, this is serious business here. Psalm 141 and verse 3 says, "Set a watch, O Lord, before my mouth. Keep the door of my lips." That's a good prayer that we should all pray. Set a watch, which means, you know, a watch that somebody that is looking out for an enemy coming, you know, something that's keeping an eye on things. Set a watch, O Lord, before my mouth. Keep the door of my lips. I repeat that little phrase to myself often. Keep the door of my lips. Be careful what you say. Compare that with Psalm 39 and verse 1. Psalm 39 and verse 1. You didn't know that you were going to have Barry White preaching to you this morning, did you? Psalm 39 and verse 1. The psalmist says, David says, I said, I will take heed to my ways, that I sin not with my tongue. See, what you say can be sinful. You can say slanderous things which are sinful. You can say hurtful things that are sinful. You can just say filthy things that are sinful. Or you can just say too much in general, and that's sinful because the Bible says not to do that. You can sin with your tongue. I will keep my mouth with a bridle while the wicked is before me. And I think that's interesting. While the wicked is before me. Who is most likely to use your words against you? It's going to be your enemies. Be really careful what you say in front of your enemies. When you're gossiping with the guy at work who loves to gossip about other people, what do you think he's going to do as soon as you leave? He's going to go gossip about you. He's going to spread everything that you just said about that other guy to the other guy. You really want to keep the door of your lips. You really want to keep your mouth with a bridle when the wicked is before you. We should be slow to speak, slow to wrath, but swift to hear. Look in James 1:19. And while you're turning, ask yourself, am I slow to speak? When my spouse says some little sharp thing to me, am I slow to respond, or am I quick to get a good jab in their back to one-up him or her? Are you slow to speak? Something to think about. James 1, verse 19. Kids, are you slow to speak whenever your parents tell you to do something? You keep your mouth shut and do it, or do you mouth off? Think about it. James 1 and verse 19. Wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. Most people are just the opposite, myself included. I have this tendency. We're quick to speak and slow to hear. You know, think about it. Whenever you're, especially in a debate with somebody, what are you thinking about? You're not thinking about what he's saying. You're thinking, I can't wait until he pauses in conversation for 1 millisecond so I can jump in there and give him my point. Not slow to speak and quick to hear, but the opposite. But, you know, sometimes you can actually learn something from somebody. Even in a debate with your enemy, listen to what he has to say. And it's also important to know what he has to say so when you respond back, you're responding back with knowledge of what his point actually is. You know, you make sure you know that you don't just assume what somebody's going to say. He that answereth the matter before he heareth it, it's folly and shame unto him, we read in the Proverbs. Nothing is more irritating than when somebody won't let you say your piece and says, I know what you're going to say. Do you? Are you sure? Are you omniscient? Are you God? You might not know what I'm going to say. We should be slow to post and slow to tweet too, not just slow to speak. You should really be slow to post and slow to tweet. Because if you speak something, like I said, people might forget about it, not a big deal. When you post or tweet it, not only is it preserved, but it's out there for a lot of people to see. So be really, really careful what you post and tweet. And when you keep your tongue, you keep yourself from trouble. So if you want to have a peaceful life, watch what you say. That's a good start. Look in Proverbs 21 and verse 23. People get themselves into more trouble with their tongue, with what they say, than anything else. Think about it. Way more trouble. Pretty much all sin starts in the mind. It's all conceived in the mind, and then usually it comes out the mouth, and then the flesh follows after that. Proverbs 21 and verse 23 says, whoso keepeth his mouth and his tongue keepeth his soul from troubles. There's a spiritual aspect to this too. You keep your mouth, you keep your soul from trouble. Get yourself into big time trouble in body and in soul by not watching what you say. Your mouth has the ability to cause your flesh to sin. Think about that. Turn to Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 6. Now this verse is specifically speaking of taking an oath. So if you take an oath with your mouth, and then you break that oath, your mouth has caused your flesh to sin. You haven't kept the oath. That's what he's specifically speaking of here. But just think about the principle that your mouth can cause your body to sin. Look at Ecclesiastes 5, 6. It says, suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin, neither say thou before the angel that it was an error, Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thine hands? There's another aspect to this also, and this is kind of taking the verse out of context, but the verse just reminds me of the point. I'm not saying this verse is a proof text for it, but a lot of sin, if you vocalize something first, it's a lot easier to commit the sin. You know, if you maybe have a thought of lust, you have a thought of fornication with your girlfriend, well then as you talk it out, you talk about things, it becomes way easier to do it. You break down barriers when you talk about things, then you can much more easily do them. Or for instance, you know, if you see something a lot, like the gay pride parades, when you watch that, if you see that year after year after year, eventually your inhibitions are broken down and you don't have defenses like you used to. Whenever you're familiarized with something, it's a lot easier to accept it, and it's a lot easier to fall into that sin. So be careful what you watch and what you say. It's very important. And I don't even like to see, I don't look at gay pride parades or on the internet or pictures. I don't want to see any of that stuff. I don't want to be desensitized at all to that stuff. I want to hate it with a passion. So I don't even want to look at it. It's disgusting. Now, the longer you keep yapping, the more likely it is for you to slip into sin. And this goes, I mean, police officers, lawyers, they know this kind of thing. Just get the guy talking. Just keep him talking, and eventually he will condemn himself. Look in Proverbs 10 and verse 19. Proverbs 10, 19. It says, in the multitude of words, there wanteth not sin. It means there lacks not sin. But he that refraineth his lips is wise. So if you're speaking a whole lot, there's going to be no lack of sin in there. Eventually, you're going to condemn yourself. You're going to say too much. So you got to be very careful with that. I mean, how many times have you been sitting around with a guy, it's just kind of having guy talk, and before you know it, things are said that shouldn't be said because you just got carried away and one thing led to another. In a multitude of words, there wanteth not sin. If you give a person enough rope, they'll hang themselves with it. Sometimes you can do that in a debate. Just let the guy keep talking. Let him keep talking, and eventually he'll say way too much, and he will condemn himself. See, it's a fool that says everything that's on his mind. You don't have to say everything you think. It's not a lie to not say something you think. You know that movie Liar, Liar? I don't know if you've seen it. It's kind of funny, but it really, I mean, he wouldn't have been lying not to say all those things. You know, does this dress make me look fat? Absolutely. Well, you don't have to say everything. You can just say, I don't know what. Just say something that's true, that's not a lie, and whatever. It's not the dress that makes you look fat. It's your fat content or whatever. But anyway, that probably wouldn't help. But so anyway, you don't always have to, especially if somebody doesn't ask, you don't have to go up to somebody and say, hey, that dress makes you look fat. You're not going to be a liar for just keeping your mouth shut. Look in Proverbs 19, 29 and verse 11. Now, are you one of these kind of people that just whatever comes up comes out and you've got to say whatever's on your mind? You just let fly? It's not wise. Proverbs 29:11 says, a fool uttereth all his mind, but a wise man keepeth it in till afterwards. It's called venting. You wait until after the fact. If you have a disagreement with your boss, don't just let him have it and tell him everything you think about him and how he's a terrible manager. Keep it until afterwards and talk to yourself about it. Talk to God about it. Maybe talk to a trusted friend about it or something. But keep it until afterwards. You don't have to say everything that you think at the time. Have you ever heard somebody boasting about how they told someone off? Oh, I told that guy off. Like it's some kind of a virtue. That's not a virtue, it's a vice. It's not a good thing to be telling people off. And people brag about this. Like, oh, that took a lot of manliness. Boy, I just let that guy have it. Any fool can tell somebody off. That doesn't take any strength whatsoever. It takes strength to hold back what you think about the guy. He that hath no rule over his own spirit is like a city that's broken. It's broken down and without walls. If you have rule over your spirit, you're a strong person. There's another proverb that goes along with it, and I can't remember it right now. Maybe it'll come to me later. Now, a fool's lips will swallow up himself. See, like I said, all you have to do is just let him keep talking, and he will condemn himself. He will destroy himself by his words. Look at Ecclesiastes 10, 11 through 13. I hope my voice is not too distracting for you this morning. Ecclesiastes 10, 11 through 13. It says, surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. See, a babbler is dangerous. He'll bite without enchantment. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. Interesting there how Jason mentioned to us about how the serpent swallows its prey whole. Well, here, the fool swallows himself. He literally turns his mouth around and swallows his whole self and destroys himself with his words. That just came to me right there on the spot. I like it when that happens. An unbridled tongue, in person or online, makes a Christian's religion vain. And this is where the rubber meets the road. This is where it gets really important. See, because James says that your religion can be nullified by what you say. You can believe all the truth. You can have all the truth. You can know it, practice it. And all these other guys out there, they're all wrong. They don't have the truth. I've got the true faith, the true church. I've got it. I've got the King James Bible. You don't bridle your tongue, you just invalidated all that religion. It's vain. You think about that. Look in James 1:26. James says, if any man among you seem to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, this man's religion is vain. To bridle, you need to put a bridle on a horse so you can control it. If you don't control your tongue, your religion is vain. Pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the father and widows in their affliction and to keep himself unspotted from the world. You don't bridle your tongue, though. You may as well just skip out on the whole religion thing, because God or men are not going to be impressed. If you're a person that's out there tattling all the time, if you're a person that's out there gossiping all the time or just going into a fit of rage, and then you want to tell somebody, well, let me tell you about the truth of sovereign grace, he's going to be like, I don't want to listen to you. I mean, my goodness, you can't keep your tongue whatsoever. Why would you want to listen to somebody like that? Winston Churchill, I think most of us are familiar with him. He was the Prime Minister of Great Britain in World War II. He said, we are masters of the unsaid words, but slaves of those we let slip out. You think about that. Masters of the unsaid words. It takes a lot of strength to not say something, to hold it back. But slaves to the ones we let slip out. You let the words slip out, and guess what? You can't take them back. And you can be a slave to them. You have to live up to that for the rest of your life. He was a wise man in a lot of ways. Kind of declared 2 world wars and massacred millions of people. But other than that, you know, he was a pretty wise guy. Did he declare World War I? I don't know. He declared World War II. Probably not World War I. I take that back. World War II, anyway. A guy named Balthasar Gratian, which I have no idea who is. I just have his quote. Sounds like some foreigner, I guess. Balthasar, he said, be careful in speaking. There is always time to add a word, never to withdraw one. You can always go back and say, oh, I forgot to mention this. In a debate, you can always go back. It's usually sometimes it's not as good after the fact, but you can always go back and add a point in. Whenever you spout off about something that you don't know what you're talking about and you just said something that's untrue, or you said some slander about somebody or some hurtful thing, you can't take that back. You just be careful about that. In other words, think before you speak. Look at Proverbs 29 and verse 20. Proverbs 29 and verse 20 says, seest thou a man that is hasty in his words? There is more hope of a fool than of him. If you're hasty, if you're quick with your words, if you don't think before you speak, there's more hope of a fool. And you know what the Bible says about fools. Nothing good. Nothing good about a fool. But there's more hope even of a fool than of a guy that is quick with his tongue and doesn't think before he speaks. I've said this before, I'll say it again, you have 2 ears and 1 mouth, use them proportionally. Listen more than you speak. There's a wealth of information out there, way more than you have in your head, that you can learn from other people. You have a minute amount of information in your head that you can share with other people, but you can learn a lot more from them than they can learn from you. We will have to give an account to God for every idle word spoken. Look in Matthew 12 and verse 36. And this is tough stuff here. When you consider what James says about the tongue, and that no man can tame it, and that it's easier to tame all these wild beasts of the wilderness than it is the tongue. I mean, this is a serious battle that we have to fight here. And I've said this stuff before, and I'm telling you again, and if I'm here for a while, you'll hear it over and over again, because this is really important stuff, and this is things that we just need to be reminded of and continually try to implement in our own lives. Matthew 12 and verse 36, our Lord Jesus Christ said, "But I say unto you that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment." Every idle word. You know, idle just kind of means just, not important. I don't know what exactly the definition would be, but not important, just kind of just speaking about things that are just kind of, you know, just whatever, just kind of blabbing. Jesus says even words like that. I mean, we're not even talking about slander and about lies and about things like that. Just idle words in general, we will be judged for in the day of judgment. You think, well, I should never talk to anybody unless I have a specific point that I want to make. No, we don't go that far. Because in order to be human, like we've been talking about in this study, you have to communicate with people. And just the small talk is important. You have to use small talk to create and maintain relationships. And there's nothing wrong with that. But just to sit around like the Athenians did and to hear or to tell some new thing, remember that in Acts 17? That's the type of idle words where you're just sitting around just talking to talk when you should be doing something else. Those words will be judged, Jesus said. Now it's wise men. We already talked about what fools do. Wise men spare their words. Look at Proverbs 17, 27 through 28. And I don't want to lose sight of the forest for the trees here. Remember, I'm talking about sharing and saying too much on social networking. So everything that I'm saying, think about your social networking sites. Google+, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. Think about all those. Instagram and Pinterest or whatever, all the other ones. Think about that whenever you're texting. You know, think about these verses when you think about all those things. Proverbs 17, 27 through 28. Proverbs 17, 27 through 28, "He that hath knowledge spareth his words, and a man of understanding is of an excellent spirit. Even a fool, when he holdeth his peace, is counted wise, and he that shutteth his lips is esteemed a man of understanding." Our human intuition would think the opposite. We would think, oh, well, if you're a man of knowledge and you have a bunch of knowledge in your head, you're going to talk a lot because you have a lot of things to share. But the Bible says just the opposite. It says, and I wish I could remember where it was. No, not there. Ah. Well, this isn't the one I was looking for, but it's close. In Proverbs 18 and verse 4, "The words of a man's mouth are as deep waters, and the wellspring of wisdom as a flowing brook." Let me see if my cross-reference is any good. Look at Proverbs 20 and verse 5. Maybe this is the one I was looking for. There we go. "Counsel in the heart of man is like deep water, but a man of understanding will draw it out." See, the wise man doesn't go around telling everybody everything he knows. He's like that deep well. And a wise man will find that other wiser man, and he will draw that information out of him. He knows the right questions to ask to get the information out of him. I like what Ron Paul says. Unsolicited advice is useless. You out there and just indiscriminately tell everybody your good advice, it's not going to fall on receiving ears. And that's why I generally try not to do that. I know people in my life, people in my family, where I think, boy, I could just straighten their lives out. I know exactly, I just tell them, do this, do this, do this, do this, and your life would be much better. But I don't waste my breath because they didn't ask. If they ask, I'll tell them. But anyway, turn back to Job 13. And verse 5. Job 13, 5. Job 13, 5. Job said, and I He didn't have much good to say about his, quote, friends who had all the good advice for him. Job said, "Oh, that you would altogether hold your peace, and it should be your wisdom." You want to be smart? Shut up. That'll show everybody that you're smart. You shut up. Here's one of my favorite quotes from Plato, long, long time ago. He said, "Wise men speak because they have something to say. Fools, because they have to say something." I love that quote. So much wisdom in that quote. Wise people, they measure out their words, and when they have something that needs to be said, that's useful to be said, they say it. And they say just enough. Like that book that you withheld from me for so long. And the guy says, he's just so precise, and he says, just enough. I haven't forgotten about that. I'm holding a grudge. I got a chip on my shoulder about that. Anyway, but fools, they just got to say something. It kind of reminds me of Peter. You remember Peter? As sick as I am this morning, things are just kind of rolling off my tongue, and I'm thankful for that. You remember Peter, whenever on the Mount of Transfiguration, and he saw with him Moses and Elijah, and they were all transfigured before him. And Peter says, "We ought to make three tabernacles here, one for thee and one for Moses and Elijah." And it says in another place, not knowing what he said. He just thought, I've got to say something. I mean, here is Jesus is transfigured, and we got these Old Testament saints, and I just can't sit here and look like a dummy and say nothing. Let's make them three houses so you got some place to stay. You know, you don't want to be sleeping on the ground tonight. Peter just had to say something. But a wise man would hold it in. A guy named Matthew Prior, once again, I don't know who he is either, but he's got a good quote here. He said, "They never taste who always drink. They always talk who never think." Think about it. If you just drink constantly, you're not going to taste anything. Your mouth is just going to become, you know, to the point desensitized, and you're not going to be able to taste anything. Well, it works the same way whenever you speak. Those who always talk never think. You can't think when you're talking very well, unless you're trying to talk things out in your head. But if you're just talking to other people, you're not really thinking. You're just kind of letting out what's already in there, and you're not building up new knowledge. I love this one, too. This is unknown. I couldn't find who spoke this quote. So the problem with closed-minded people is that their mouth is always open. Think about that. Their mouth is always open. You know who said it?
I don't know who said it, but there's another one that's on here. "Better to remain silent and be thought a fool than to open one's mouth and remove all doubt."
Yep. As a matter of fact, I have that one written right here in pen on the outline. Thank you. Actually, I went right over it. It was right after Plato. Yeah, in case you didn't hear him, "Better to remain silent and have men think you a fool than to open your mouth and remove all doubt." I've been in that situation before at work when I didn't really understand what was going on or didn't know what needed to be done. And I thought, you know, if I don't say anything, they may think I'm an idiot and not really know what I'm doing. But I'll just keep quiet and at least have them wonder if I'm an idiot rather than open my mouth and make them assuredly know it. So anyway, yeah, just better to keep your mouth shut. People may think you're a fool, but that's all right. Open your mouth, they'll know. I like what Fred Hodgins said. I don't know. I think his dad said this. I don't know where he got it. I heard him say it one time in a sermon, a guy from Detroit. He said, "They that know the least know it the loudest." That's interesting, too. You know, I used to be that way. Thought I knew all kinds of stuff about religion and about the Bible. In retrospect, I didn't know anything. I mean, I don't even think I'd read through the New Testament in my life yet. Thought I knew everything, telling everybody everything, and I didn't know what I was talking about. "A fool's voice is known by multitude of words." Look in Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 3. If you want to know who a fool is, find the guy that just talks endlessly, and that's a pretty good indication. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 3. "For a dream cometh through the multitude of business, and a fool's voice is known by multitude of words." Always remember that you have the right and often the duty to remain silent. Those Miranda rights are important. You have the right to remain silent. It is important with the police. It's important in general, though. You have the right to remain silent. You remember what Jesus said to Pilate? It was said of Jesus that he witnessed a good confession before Pontius Pilate. You know what his confession was? Nothing. He didn't say anything. That was his good confession. He did say things to him at another time, but part of his good confession was to make Pilate marvel because he said nothing. That could just irritate enemies. You imagine being brought up, they're ready to burn you at the stake. What do you have to say for yourself? And just say nothing. Don't say, oh, please, please, don't hurt me. Just don't say anything. Drive them up the wall. You have the right to remain silent. And I will just add this in. With police, you have the right, and if you're a smart person, you will remain silent. Don't say anything. If you get pulled over, I think you have to tell them license and registration, and you have to answer a few questions, where are you going, or something like that. But policeman knocks on your door, says, I'm investigating a murder, or this or that. Don't say anything. Because if you do, it can be used against you. Anything, as they say in the Miranda rights, anything you say can and will be used against you in the court of law. It doesn't say anything you say can be used to exonerate you in the court of law. It says to be used against you. Don't say anything. You have the Fifth Amendment. You don't have to testify against yourself. Even if you're completely innocent, don't say anything. You say, oh, I want to help him solve a crime. I'm telling you, if you're wise, don't say anything, especially in this police state that we live in nowadays. Just keep your mouth shut. Because I watched a video on this where a guy made a presentation, and he showed that the most innocent things that you could say, he showed how they could be turned around every time, and you could end up being put at the scene of a crime or something because maybe you inadvertently said something wrong, or maybe everything you said was absolutely true, but who knows what happens, and it gets misconstrued. Or you tell a police officer something, he hears it, it wasn't recorded, then he reports back what you said, maybe what he says wasn't what you said. And then what are you going to say? Then how are you going to exonerate yourself? So anyway, I would recommend, don't say anything. Just keep your mouth shut. A fool is full of words. This will be my last verse on this topic, I think. Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 14. It says, a fool is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be and what shall be after him. Who can tell him? All right, I think I've made my case pretty well. Charles Spurgeon said, it is not a severe criticism to say that there are ministers whose words stand in a very large proportion to their thoughts. I thought that one was pretty good. He said that back in the 1800s. You know, preachers that don't have much to say have been around for a while. It's not just a new phenomenon. Let's talk about how Facebook and Twitter facilitate busybodiness. Paul instructed young widows to remarry, to bear children, to guide the house, in part because of their propensity to become tattlers and busybodies. Do you remember that? Look in 1 Timothy 5, 11 through 14. 1 Timothy 5, 11 through 14. This is part of Paul's reasoning here, why he said that young widows should marry again. He says, but the younger widows refuse, for when they have begun to wax wanton against Christ, they will marry, having damnation because they have cast off their first faith. And withal they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, and not only idle, but tattlers also, and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully, for some are already turned aside after Satan. So if you're married, bearing children, guiding the house, you're not going to have time to run around from house to house and be saying things you ought not. But you can imagine a young widow, 25 years old, is widowed, especially if her husband had a little money left to her and she didn't have to go out there and try to make it on her own. She's going to be running around, you know, just being the chatty Cathy, the town gossiper. And that's what Paul is warning against here. Now think about this. Facebook has now made it possible for young women, and too often young mothers at home with their children, to digitally wander about from house to house, being busybodies and speaking things which they ought not. You don't have to go physically from house to house. You can digitally go house to house and say things you ought not. And a lot of times this is a problem with young mothers that have children at home. The poor ladies don't have any adult to talk to all day long. They're just around screaming, crying kids, and probably half out of their wits, and they get online and start Facebooking and talking and that kind of thing. So be careful about that. Being a busybody is no trivial matter. Look in 1 Peter 4 and verse 15. 1 Peter 4:15 says, "But let none of you suffer as a murderer or as a thief or as an evildoer or as a busybody in other men's matters." If you don't want to be characterized with murderers and thieves, I wouldn't be a busybody, because it's lumped right in there with the same thing. It's a serious thing, serious charge. Excuse me. Much strife has come as a result of posting unnecessary things online. And I've heard of plenty of this, you know, where people, family members or whatever, online, Facebooking, talking about this, that, or the other thing, and it gets them into strife with family or friends or whatever, and it wouldn't be necessary. Okay, let's talk about the tendency to compare ourselves via social networking. This could be comparing ourselves in general with other people, but I'm focusing on the digital aspect of it, on the social networking aspect of it, but apply it to any area of life. Keeping up with the Joneses used to be restricted to your next door neighbor. You know, you had looked at the next door neighbors, they had the bigger house, I need the bigger house. They had the nice new cars, I need the cars. They had the boat, they had the four-wheeler, they had the snowmobile, they had the whatever. I got to keep up with that. They got three kids, well, we better get busy, I want three kids too. You know, now, we have to keep up with the Joneses all over the planet, all of our friends on Facebook. It's not just the next door neighbors anymore. A guy named Jesse Rice, who wrote a book, I think it was a book, called The Church of Facebook, he had this great quote here, and I think this is powerful, and this is so true. And I'll read you this, and especially the last sentence, and you tell me if this isn't true. He said, "Fear is very much part of the climate of Facebook. When we are afraid of what people think of us, we work hard to craft just the right image, composed of just the right pictures, personal information, and status updates. The emphasis is on being clever, not on being genuine." That is the truth, my friends. The emphasis is on being clever, not on being genuine. And you know it's true. Look at people's Facebook posts and status updates and so on. They want to be clever. They're not about there just putting just facts about themselves generally. They want to make it in such a way where people are amused and entertained by it. Makes them popular. Comparing ourselves among ourselves, as we read this morning, is not wise. Look at 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12. And I think Mr. Rice nailed it right on the head. That's why people do that, is because they are afraid of not being able to keep up with others. They are afraid of looking inferior to others, so they want to make this appearance online that they are just this pristine individual that has everything together. And you can do that online. It's harder to do it in person. You know, you can't really get one over on somebody in person. They can see you. They know you. They know who you are. But online, that's a different story. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12 says, "For we dare not make ourselves of the number or compare ourselves with some that commend themselves, but they measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves are not wise." Not wise to compare yourself among others. Even in the church, it's not wise there. It's not wise to look at your brethren and say, "Well, boy, he's smarter than I am," or "he knows the scripture better than I do," or "he's a nicer person than I am," or whatever. You know, "he's got a nice family," or "he's got a beautiful wife," or so on and so on. You don't want to do that. You don't want to compare yourself among other people. Our example, the Apostle Paul, you can see that in 1 Corinthians 11:1. He says, "Be ye followers of me as I am of Christ." He's our example. He didn't commend himself, nor did he need others to commend him. See, Paul was a mature Christian. Look in 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 1. And this is the point we all want to be. We all want to get to the point where we don't care what other people think about ourselves. We don't need to be commended by other people. We only care what the Lord thinks. 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 1. Paul says, "Do we begin again to commend ourselves, or need we, as some others, epistles of commendation to you, or letters of commendation from you?" Paul says, no, we don't need that. You know why? "Ye are our epistle written in our hearts, known and read of all men." I don't need people to commend me. I've got this church here, which are the first fruits of my labor. You can see what I've done here. I don't need anybody to commend me. That's what Paul says. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 4, 3 through 4, just thought about this morning. I will put it in the outline. He said there, it's a small thing to be judged of other people. Paul wasn't worried about it. In 1 Corinthians 4, 3 through 4, he said, "But with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged of you, or of man's judgment. Yea, I judge not mine own self. For I know nothing by myself, yet I am not hereby justified. But he that judgeth me is the Lord." He says, it's a small thing. I don't lose any sleep at night over you people judging me. What you think of me doesn't matter to me. You point me, thus saith the scripture, and you show me I've done something wrong. Okay, now I'm concerned about your judgment. But what you think of me in general, I don't care. I'm not worried about it, Paul says. And we should all be that way. If you care what people think of you, you have not yet grown up. Kids are like that, right? Especially teenagers. They care what their friends think about them. The peer pressure thing. They want to be in the in crowd. They want to be popular, right? That's what kids do. Adults shouldn't do that. And it's funny. Elderly people get that way too. My mom lives down in Florida, and she lives in a retirement home down there. And she cracks me up when she tells me about the people, and she's young to live down there. A lot of the people are up in years, in their 80s. But she said it's like being in high school again. I mean, they bicker about stupid stuff. She said two people were standing outside the other day, and they were arguing about who lived on the best street or something in the park. I mean, that's what goes on there. It's funny. They have these two swans, Chipper and Dipper. And people just get all up in arms about these swans, and they write stuff in the local little paper about the swans and what needs to be done with them. And it's funny. But anyway, people, they go back to acting childish. The older you get sometimes. You start
more petty than high school.
You're more petty than high
school. We did that with more petty than high school.
Yeah. It's funny, you start out in diapers and you end up in diapers. Yeah. We'll all get there, so.
They call them defenses. The defenses in the will.
Yeah. That's right. That's good. It has been said, pardon me. It has been said that when you're 18, you care about what everybody thinks about you. When you're 40, you don't care about what anybody thinks about you. And when you're 60, you realize that nobody thinks about you. Oh, I like that one. But God thinks of you, and that's all that matters. That's what matters. Turn back to Isaiah 49 and verse 16. It doesn't matter if nobody thinks about you. God thinks about you. Paul said when he was in prison that in my first answer, no man stood with me, but all men forsook me. But what did he say after that? Yet the Lord stood with me. The Lord stood with him. That's all that matters. Isaiah 49 and verse 16. Behold, God says, I have graven thee upon the palms of my hands. Thy walls are continually before me. God remembers you. Every time he looks at his hands, he's got your name tattooed there. Got all of our names there. He cares about you. Now, people tend to make their lives look like a fairy tale on Facebook. They appear to have the perfect life, the perfect marriage, perfect kids, perfect job, perfect social life, etc. Don't they? I mean, you look on there and you think, wow, this person is just, it's like he's just living the dream. She's living the dream. I wish my family was like that. When you compare your real life with their virtual life, I lost my place. I hate it when that happens. Just totally negated the point. When you compare your real life to their virtual life, you appear to fall short. The rest of the point wasn't even long. I could have just, could have said it. I thought maybe there was something important there, Anyway, I'm not going to go on Facebook and post how terrible of a comment that was. When you compare your real life with their virtual life, you think you fall short. But the thing is, you're comparing your real life with their virtual life. You're not comparing real for real. That's not, more than likely, that's not their real life. You are not at home with them every night. You don't see what goes on in their home. They probably don't have it all together, like their Facebook page portrays. And you're trying to, in your heart, imitate a phony life. So you're trying to imitate something that's not even real. It'd be like watching, one of these TV shows and trying to imitate your life, like The Young and the Restless. Oh, I just want to sit around in a three-piece suit all the time and dining gowns and have affairs with my neighbor's friend or something. I mean, that would be a terrible thing to try to imitate. But you can imagine if you're going to try to imitate the lifestyles of the rich and famous, it's not real. Can't do that. Even if they do have it all together and they have the, quote, perfect life, you should still not try to compare yourself with them. Even if they do have the perfect life, don't worry about it. Just worry about what God has given you. Be thankful for the wife and the husband you have, for the kids that you have, for the family you have. Don't worry about other people's lives and what they might have. The only standard you should try to measure up to is God's standard found in the scripture. That's the standard. Look at what the Bible says and compare yourself against that. Don't be covetous of what others have. Be content with what you have. Look at Hebrews 13 and verse 5. This is important because you're just going to be an uncontented, unhappy person if you're constantly looking around, especially at people's fake lives on Facebook and trying to compare yourselves with that. You're never going to measure up. And then what you're going to end up doing is you're going to make yourself a fake virtual life on Facebook and make it look way better than it is. And then some other poor guy is going to look at your fake life and try to measure up to your fake life. And then he's going to make a fake life. And it's going to be a perpetuating cycle. Hebrews 13 and verse 5. Let your conversation be without covetousness, and be content with such things as ye have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. See why it's important to be content with what you have. Connected with that is God's promise that he won't forsake you. He's graven you on his hands. It's what he cares about you. It's how he cares about you that's important, not what other people think. And don't worry about what God has given to others either. This is something that even the apostles of Jesus Christ fell into. Look at the book of John 21, 20 through 22. John 21, 20 through 22. If you remember, right before Jesus ascended back to heaven, he was sitting with his disciples, and the disciple whom Jesus loved, which was more than likely the apostle John, was laying there with his head on his bosom. And Peter was concerned about what's going to happen to John. Peter wasn't worried about himself, but he was worried about John. And it says there, Then Peter turning about, seeth the disciple whom Jesus loved following, which also leaned on his breast at supper, and said, Lord, which is he that betrayeth thee? So that's what John said. Peter didn't say, Lord, which is he that betrayeth thee? John, laying on his bosom in a previous time, asked Jesus, who betrayed thee? Peter's just identifying who this disciple is. Peter, seeing him, saith to Jesus, Lord, and what shall this man do? Jesus saith unto him, If I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? Follow thou me. So Jesus says, you know what? Don't worry about John. What if my will is for him that he's going to be alive until the second coming? Peter didn't know when the second coming was. What if that's the case? Jesus says, don't worry about it. What is that to thee? It's none of your business. Follow thou me. You just worry about what I've got for you. Because the thing is, poor old Peter, Jesus just told him that Peter's going to die a death of a martyr. People are going to lead him where he would not. And he says that in verse 18. They're going to stretch forth thine hands. He's going to be crucified, right? Peter says, well, boy, I'm going to be crucified. What's going to happen to John? I want to know what's going to happen to him. Is he going to be beside me? I want to make sure that I'm not in this thing alone. He said, well, what if I give John a nice cushy life for the rest of his life and he gets to see me at the second coming? None of your business, Peter. Don't worry about it. That's what he says to him. Just don't worry about what God's done for others. Our completeness is in Christ, and we should not seek it anywhere else. Look at Colossians 2 and verse 10. Colossians 2 and verse 10. It says, and ye are complete in him, which is the head of all principality and power. Talking about Christ. That's where we get our completeness. Only in Christ. Okay, now I'm going to switch topics. I'm going to talk about cyber stalking for a minute. So just get your minds totally out of what I was just talking about. This is something quite different. This is more practical instruction than anything else. I'm just covering all these problems in the digital invasion, the problems that we have to face now. Cyber stalking is one of them. Stalking has been made easier with the internet, with the anonymity it affords. Before, yet, when you stalk somebody, I mean, you kind of had to, you know, go hang out at their house or something, or I don't know what. But now, with the internet, it's really easy to stalk somebody on Facebook. You know, you can follow them and be friends with them and see everything that they do and find out where they are and so on. But here's just a few practical tips to avoid being cyber-stalked. Number one, make sure that the location services on your cell phone are disabled for the photographs. If you don't know how to do this, talk to some young person and they'll help you. I can help you. On the iPhone, I can definitely help you. On the Android, I'm not sure. I probably could figure it out. But anyway, you just go in there, go to privacy, I think it is, location services, deselect photos. Because what happens is, if location services is enabled on photos, every time you take a picture, it is digitally stamped with the location, with the GPS coordinates where that picture was taken. Anybody with an internet browser add-on can then look at that picture online, just basically right-click it, location or whatever, something like that, and they can find the GPS coordinates of exactly where that picture was taken, right down to your house, probably even your bedroom. So when you got these kids, like you, with a phone, you're snapping pictures, location services enabled, you put this on Facebook, you put it somewhere else, some sexual predator goes out there, and he can find out exactly where you are, exactly where you live, even where your bedroom is in your house. They can find everything about you. So make sure you turn off that if you don't do anything else. That's important. Someone with this, like I said, with an internet browser could find out where your home is, where your school is, where your vacation spot is, anything. I mean, they could track you all over the place. Don't post your location or your whereabouts on Facebook. Don't post where you are or where you will be for everyone else to see. Have you ever met dumb people like that? Have you ever been a dumb person like that and say, oh, I'm going here tonight, I'm going on vacation this weekend, I won't be home, anybody that wants to rob my house, come on over. I mean, that's the stupidest thing you can do. I don't have a dog either, so there's not going to be any noise, don't worry about it. That might be a good idea to catch thieves. Just say, hey, I'm going to be away all weekend and sit at home with your gun and wait for him to come, you know, rid the world of evil. But especially, I already said that, never mind. Teach your children to never, and this is very important, to never meet somebody in person whom they've only met online. You kids, never meet somebody in person whom you've only met online. If you're a child, I mean, if you're an adult and it's a dating website or something, if you're a girl, be careful. If you're a guy, I wouldn't worry about it. But if you're a girl, be careful with that. You might want to do a double date or something like that, or at least let people know where you're going to be, meet in a public place, and so on. But kids, never, 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 never meet somebody that you've only met online. There are sick and twisted individuals out there that pretend to be people your age, and they do awful things to children. I know of a person whose daughter was raped by some goons she met on Facebook or MySpace. I think it was MySpace. This is a few years ago. Guy I worked with. Daughter, I think she might have been 18, 17 or 18. Anyway, met some goons on Facebook or MySpace, went to a party with them, was drugged, the date rape drug, and was raped. She didn't even know it, you know, because she was unconscious. Know who your children are conversing with online, because there are sexual predators out there masquerading as peers for your children. The thing is, you can put up any picture of yourself you want on there in a chat room or on Facebook or whatever. You can put up a picture as you're a 14-year-old boy and you're talking to this girl and you're talking like you're a 14-year-old boy to a 13-year-old girl. And it's really some 40-year-old reprobate that's trying to get you to meet with him. That happens all the time. People have done it. News reporters have done that very thing. They've went on there, posed as 13-year-old girls, talking to some pig, and then go meet him at his house with a video camera. They should meet him with a gun, bang, as soon as he opens the door. But anyway, that kind of thing happens. There are sickos out there. If your children are being cyber-stalked or cyber-bullied, then get them off the internet, or at least the specific parts in which the stalking is taking place. So if they're your kids, you are the parents, do it. If they're being cyber-stalked, get them off the internet. If they're having problems on the internet with other things that we talk about in this study, get them off the internet. That's your job. You're the parent, remember? All right, let's talk about internet gambling. Switching gears again. Dr. Hart in The Digital Invasion had this to say about internet gambling and gambling addictions in general. I don't know if any of you have problems with internet gambling, but I figured I would cover this anyway. He said, estimates of the number of people who are diagnosed with gambling addiction are difficult to find. It appears to range anywhere from 2 to 5% of the population of the United States. This may seem like a low percentage, but in real numbers, it means that many millions of people are affected by it in the United States alone. He says, unfortunately, this disorder does not respond well to treatment, and as many as two-thirds of those who begin treatment for gambling disorder discontinue their treatment prematurely. It makes no difference whether treatment includes medication, psychotherapy, or both. It is a difficult habit to give up. So based on that, I would say, don't get yourself involved in internet gambling or any type of gambling. It's highly addictive, and you can really end up ruining your life. You can bet the farm, as they say, and lose everything. Gambling in itself may not be a sin, but to be addicted to it is. And I'm going to talk more about addictions later, probably in two Sundays from now, I think. Maybe next Saturday. Probably the Sunday after next, I think. Anyway. Addiction. This is an interesting definition. The first part of the definition, or the primary definition, goes back to Roman law. And when you read this definition, you'd be like, that doesn't sound like what I think of when I think of addiction. But you'll see where the usage that we use of it comes from this. So it's a formal giving over or delivery by sentence of court, hence a surrender or dedication of anyone to a master. You see that? That was what it was. Addiction was whenever some criminal was handed over to the court, and he is now in the power of the court, the power of somebody else. So you see where I'm going with this, or where the dictionary is going with this. Number two is the state of being self-addicted or given to a habit or pursuit, devotion. It's the or a state of being addicted to a drug. See addicted, past participle 3b, which I will define presently. It's a compulsion and need to continue taking a drug as a result of taking it in the past. So we all know what addiction is. It's whenever you get hooked on something and you can't stop. It has power over you at that point. Now, to be addicted to anything, like I just said, is to allow it to have power over you. That's the nature of the addiction, okay? The Bible teaches that we're not to be brought under the power of anything. Look in 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 12. And like I said, I'm just kind of hitting a few points here. I have more to say about this later. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 12. It says, all things are lawful unto me, Paul says, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. It may be lawful for you to take a drink. It is not lawful for you to be brought under the power of alcohol, to be drunk or to be addicted to it. All things are lawful, but you don't be brought under the power of them. We must keep our body, including our brain, which is prone to get addicted to dopamine, in subjection and not let it control us. So when Paul talks about keeping under his body, that includes your brain too. Your brain is part of your body. Look in 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 27. 1 Corinthians 9, 27. Paul says, but I keep under my body and bring it into subjection, lest by any means when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. So, like I said, when you keep the body under, you got to keep the brain under too. The brain gets addicted to a thing called dopamine. That's why they call drugs dope, because the drugs, I guess, produce dopamine or something, or have the same effect as dopamine. I'm not a neurosurgeon, but anyway, and other things release dopamine into the brain too. And I'll get into that when I talk about video gaming, which I'm going to talk about next. All those type of things, they release adrenaline, they release dopamine, and your brain gets hooked on that stuff. That's why it's addictive. You got to keep your brain and your body under. You got to keep it in subjection. Sin must not be allowed to reign in our bodies. To reign is to have power, sway, or predominance, to prevail or be prevalent. So we can't let sin have power and dominance in our lives. We have to control it, not let it control us. Look at Romans 6 and verse 12. Romans 6 and verse 12 says, let not sin therefore reign in your mortal body, that ye may obey it in the lust thereof. You make it obey you. You don't obey it. Don't let it have dominion in your body. We must not yield, which means to hand over, give up, relinquish, possession of, surrender, or resign. We must not yield or surrender, give up our body to sin and let it have dominion, which is power or right of governing and controlling, sovereign authority, lordship, sovereignty, rule, sway, control, influence over us. So we don't yield. We don't give over our body. We don't relinquish the possession of our body over to sin and let it have the control and the lordship and the sovereignty over us. We cannot do that. Romans 6:13-14. Neither yield ye your members as instruments of unrighteousness unto sin, but yield yourselves unto God as those that are alive from the dead, and your members as the instruments of righteousness unto God. For sin shall have no dominion, or shall not have dominion over you, for ye are not under the law, but under grace. You need to yield your body to God. We need to serve our God with our bodies, not serve our bodies with our mind. Did you get that? We need to serve God with our bodies, not serve our bodies with our mind. Think about that. Even if the act of gambling is not sinful, it is not wise. I can guarantee you that. I'm not saying you can never go to Las Vegas and do a quarter machine or a slot machine or something like that. I don't think it's a good idea. But if you want to go there and limit yourself to $5, $10, $100, whatever, and just say, I will spend this amount of money just for fun, just like I'm going out for dinner tonight, I'm going to blow $100 or whatever, that's all right. But, you know, don't take your credit card, for goodness sakes, and, you know, don't mortgage your house or anything. But even if it's lawful, is it wise? See, lawful things are not always expedient. Look at 1 Corinthians 10:23. I mean, it may be lawful to go and eat Big Macs every day for the rest of your life, but is it expedient? Your life is going to be a lot shorter if you do that. 1 Corinthians 10:23 says, all things are lawful for me, but all things are not expedient. All things are lawful for me, but all things edify not. The allure of gambling is getting something for nothing, or almost nothing. That's why people want to gamble. It's the chance to win big, to get something for nothing. And isn't that what our human nature loves? We love to get something for nothing. Except when it comes to salvation. And then our human nature reels against that. You know, God says, hey, I give salvation to whoever I want, and it's free, and you got to do nothing to get it. And men say, well, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of. I got to do something to get it. But then most people like a free lunch. Most people like government checks. You know, most people like all that kind of stuff, something for nothing. But when it comes to God giving you something for nothing, for some reason we don't like that. But the Bible says that wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished. Look at Proverbs 13 and verse 11. I hope the sermon's almost over. My voice is about shot. Proverbs 13:11. I should have made this a short little sermonette if I was smart. But Proverbs 13:11. Wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished, but he that gathereth by labor shall increase. If you want to become wealthy, you must work and work hard. That's how it works. There are a few people that get inheritance. There are a few people that hit the lottery. There are a few people that just manage to stumble into something and hit it big. But most people just have to work hard for their whole lives. And if you get the wealth by vanity, it will be diminished. It's not going to last. Just talk to somebody that's won the lottery. How long does it last? Most people can't handle it. Most people can't. Even in the rare occurrence that somebody hits the jackpot gambling, it will not end well. Proverbs 20 and verse 21. The type of person that's going gambling with hopes that he hits it big is probably not a virtuous individual. And if he does hit it big, he's not going to be able to manage that money wisely. He's probably going to be back at the casino to hit it big again. Don't you think? Proverbs 20 and verse 21 says, an inheritance may be gotten hastily at the beginning, but the end thereof shall not be blessed. Just think about a windfall win at the casino. It may be gotten hastily, but the end thereof won't be blessed. The prosperity of fools, Proverbs tells us, will destroy them. Proverbs 1 in verse 32. For the turning away of the simple shall slay them, and the prosperity of fools shall destroy them. That's why if you're smart, you'll pray the prayer that the person that wrote Proverbs 30, I think it was Agur, the son of Jakeh, He said, give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of the Lord or take the name of my God in vain. You want poverty nor riches. You want that middle station of life. Not a good idea to hit it big. Your life won't be as glorious as you think. The Bible prescribes labor, not chance, for acquiring wealth. Look at Proverbs 14 and verse 23. Proverbs 14:23. In all labor there is profit, but the talk of the lips tendeth only to penury. That's an old word for poverty. In other words, talk is cheap. In labor, no matter what the labor is, no matter if you're laboring flipping burgers at McDonald's or what you're laboring in, there is profit. There is no such thing as a dishonorable job as long as you're not sinning when you're doing it. But the talk of the lips, oh, I'm going to get this job. I'm going to hit it big. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. That tends to poverty. You've got to be doers of the word, not hearers of the word only. Look at Proverbs 10 and verse 4. It says, he becometh poor that dealeth with a slack hand, but the hand of the diligent maketh rich. That's the key to riches, to be diligent, to work hard. But you deal with a slack hand, like a slacker, you're going to be poor. The gamblers are not in good company. You can probably think of a few in the scripture if you think about it. If you haven't thought about it, turn to Mark 15 and verse 24, and this may jog your memory. Mark 15 and verse 24. Whenever Jesus was hanging on the cross, some guys were setting up a little casino. Mark 15 and verse 24. And when they had crucified him, they parted his garments, casting lots for them, what every man should take. So casting lots is kind of like straws or something, you know, where they had some method wherever they picked out of a hat or something, and then that determined who got what. So it's kind of like a primitive form of gambling. Look at Joel 3 and verse 3. And if this one doesn't describe Las Vegas, I don't know what does. Joel 3 and verse 3. It says, and they have cast lots for my people, and have given a boy for an harlot, and sold a girl for wine, that they might drink. You're not in good company whenever you're hanging around with gamblers. Not a good idea. Now, if you're addicted to gambling online or other, follow the steps that are outlined in section 12, which will be Saturday, I do believe, or maybe probably Sunday. Anyway, it's coming up soon. For dealing with a sinful addiction. Now, addictions will be further discussed in the section on internet addiction in section 15. And if necessary, seek professional help. All right, this is the last section. This won't take long at all. On video games. Dr. Hart in The Digital Invasion had this to say about video game playing and addiction. He said, as we write this book, it is estimated that 95 to 97% of our youth, please forgive the collectivist, socialistic terminology, our youth. But anyway, 95 to 97% of our youth are playing video games of one sort or another. He says, video game addiction, also known as video game overuse, is the extreme use of video games to the extent that it interferes with daily life. Gambling addiction is a form, gaming addiction is a form of impulse control disorder. People with this impulse control disorder can't resist the urge to engage in behaviors that harm themselves or others and are disposed toward developing other addictions such as alcohol, drugs, eating disorders, and compulsive gambling. The impulse to play these games is overwhelming. Teens are the most vulnerable to gaming addictions, and their need to play can be excessive to the extent it is harmful to themselves or to others. He continues. What causes gaming addiction? Again, the pleasure and reward system of the brain plays a major role in delivering extreme euphoria while gaming. This also explains why it is so addicting. Gaming provides a make-believe world for the gamer, providing an escape from the real world. In the case of a gamer in China who committed suicide, the head of one software association was quoted saying, In the hypothetical world created by such games, they become confident and gain satisfaction, which they cannot get in the real world. Same thing goes with the social networking stuff that I was talking about earlier. But it works this way with video games as well. He continues, Kevin Roberts, a nationally recognized expert on video gaming addiction, offers the following risk rating for major games. The risk goes from 1 to 10, 10 being the severest. Probably should be most severe, but I'm just quoting from him. Anyway, I didn't do the first ones like Tetris and whatever else. I kind of cut to the chase and just started with risk addiction risk 7. So first-person shooter games like Counter-Strike, Halo, and Call of Duty have an addiction risk of 7. I've heard of Halo and Call of Duty. I don't think of any of the rest of the games I'm going to mention here I've not heard of. I'm not a gamer. The last video gaming I did was when I was about 10 years old. It was the original Nintendo, the first one. I didn't have the Atari. I'm not as old as some of you guys, but the original Nintendo, and that was it. Sorry. That was below the belt. Sorry. All right. There weren't even, they didn't even have electricity back when you were a kid, bud, right? I mean, there was no video games. All right. All right. Real-time strategy games like Command and Conquer, Age of Empires, Empire Earth have an addiction risk of 7. Has anybody ever heard of those games? Okay. Chris is smiling. You play them? Oh, you are under the pastor's laser vision now. The narcotics of the game world, he says, are MMORPGs, massively multiple online role-playing. Have you heard of these? Yeah, okay. I hadn't. How do you say that? Morpgs? I don't know. Whatever. I don't even know how you say that. Whatever that acronym would be. RuneScape. You ever heard of that one? RuneScape. That is an addiction risk of 7. And World of Warcraft. Ever heard of that one? That is an addiction risk of 10. Highly addictive. And I don't know anything about those games, to be honest with you. Now, with the pervasiveness of video games, especially first-person shooter and war games, is it any wonder why the government has no problem selling their immoral and illegal wars to the public? Whenever kids are doing it from the time that they're babies, growing up, war games, first-person shooter, killing people, I'm not one to blame all the school shootings on video games, but just think about it. If you're running around, first-person shooter, murdering people for fun all the time in the virtual world, I don't know. I mean, might it not seem tempting to go out and do it for real? I don't know. I'm not saying that. I'm not blaming it on video games, and I'm not blaming it on guns. But obviously not. I mean, people are culpable for what they do. It's not the video games, but I just wonder. Is it any wonder that it is now far easier than in previous generations for a soldier to kill an enemy in battle since he's been doing it virtually since he was a child? And this is a fact. It is way more easier, and it has been since the Civil War and on, it's much easier for a soldier to kill another person in battle. They've done studies on this. In every war, I don't know when they started, but it was at least in the Civil War, they would do analysis on, I guess with polling or something, about how many soldiers would kill an enemy. And back in the Civil War, I mean, it was a small percentage. Most people wouldn't do it. When they were in battle, they wouldn't do it. They just, you know, freeze up or whatever. They would find guys' muskets. I heard of this guy's musket that was loaded in with, like, I don't know, 20 balls or something. He just kept loading in balls. He wasn't even shooting it. The whole barrel was just loaded up with balls. But anyway, as the wars went on and the army learned more psychological treatment and they learned to demoralize the enemy, dehumanize the enemy and call them gooks and hodgies and everything else, And now they train fighter pilots with video games. They train soldiers, combat soldiers with video games. Now they've broken down the inhibitions. And now in wars, people are much more likely to kill in war because they've been conditioned and it's easier for them to do it. And I just wonder if that's not why PTSD is at an all-time high with these wars. Suicide is at an all-time high. I think it's 22 people per day. 22 soldiers per day commit suicide coming back from these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. More people have died because of suicide from these wars than they did die in combat. More Americans, anyway. And we don't care about the brown people. They're not people, right? We killed hundreds of thousands of them. They're not important. But Americans, the The important people in the earth, they, more of them have died because of suicide. And of course, I'm being completely ridiculous when I say that. I'm being facetious. But anyway, I just wonder if that's not why this PTSD, thank you, couldn't think of it. PTSD is so high with these wars now because more people kill now than they did in previous wars. I don't know. But anyway, I would not doubt that video games have something to do with this. I know the military uses them, and the military knows what they're doing. They know what works. Could these type of video games elicit wicked imaginations, which God hates? Just think about it. Look in Proverbs 6:18. Could these video games elicit wicked imaginations? I don't know. If you're playing a first-person shooter game and you're getting joy out of virtually killing people, I don't know. I mean, is that a good thing to do? Proverbs 6 and verse 18. In heart that deviseth wicked imaginations, feet that be swift, running to mischief. Those are two of the six things that God hates. In heart that deviseth wicked imaginations. I mean, if you think about it, if I just sat around in my apartment today and I just thought about going out and murdering people, just think, how neat would that be? Just to go out and pop somebody in the head or whatever. You say, well, that's awful. That's terrible. That's sinful. You're committing murder in your heart. Is there a difference going on a video game? And, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe, but it's something to think about anyway. Video gaming might not be a sin, but is it wise? Like the gambling thing. Is it wise? I'm not trying to cast a snare on you. I'm not saying that it's a sin. I just give you some things to consider and you think about it. At some point, though, too much video gaming crosses over into an addiction, which would be sinful. You can look at, I will cover that in more detail in section 15. Especially if the addiction causes one to neglect obligatory duties of life. If you're just sitting there playing video games for 10 hours a day and you're not going to work or you're not taking care of the house, you're not taking care of the kids or whatever, then it definitely becomes a sin. Even if the addiction of itself is not a sin, it is a sin because it takes away from other things that you're supposed to be doing. If you're addicted to video games, follow the steps outlined in section 12, which will be next week, for dealing with a sinful addiction. Addictions will be further discussed in this section on internet addictions, as I've mentioned. Okay, so that is all I have to say about the digital invasion today. So just briefly, just to recap the main points, be careful what you say, share, and gossip on Facebook and on the social media sites. Remember, the fool is full of words. Wise man spareth his words. Don't compare yourselves with other with other people on social networking. Don't try to keep up with the Joneses and try to create some fake life online so that you can look way better than you are. Beware of cyber stalking. Turn that location services off on your photos on your smartphone if you haven't already. Don't let your kids ever meet somebody that they met online in person. Don't let them meet in person that they've only met online. Beware of gambling in general, especially internet gambling. And consider what I say about video games. So anyway, that's all I have to say about that. Lord willing, next time we will cover internet pornography. I know I said last week that I'd cover internet pornography this week, and it just didn't work out because I have too much information to cover it in one Sunday, so I want to cover it in two, and I didn't want to split it up between this Sunday and next Sunday since half the church will be here next Sunday that weren't here this Sunday, and so on and so on. So anyway, I kind of rearranged things, and I, Lord willing, will cover internet pornography next weekend. Make sure you're here for that. Very, very important. Thank you for your kind and patient attention.